The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I don't know if it's train wreck watching or pity watching or thank God I'm not out in the elements watching or just Anderson in a wet t-shirt watching. I don't know, but I know that it's successful.
It's successful. Okay.
Hi, I'm Allison Camerota, and you may know me from CNN, but you're about to hear my deepest secrets.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to Off the Beat with me, your host, Brian Baumgartner. We have a breaking news story today out of Westport, Connecticut. Renowned journalist and television personality Allison Camerota is making waves once again, this time as a guest on this podcast. Yes, Allison is a stalwart figure in the world of broadcast journalism, a reporter who has seen pretty much everything. Her career has spanned multiple decades and ideologies. She worked for many years at Fox News and is now an anchor with CNN, not to mention a stint at America's Most Wanted and local channels in Boston and Washington, D.C. But no matter where she's reporting from or for whom, she's always fair and reasoned. She has a real journalistic integrity and ethics. And that's exactly what we need in the world of news today. We're going to talk about how she bridged the gap, how she copes with the 24-hour news cycle, and her early days in the downtown New York punk scene. I really enjoyed this conversation with Allison. You can catch her on The Whole Story with Anderson Cooper these days. And you can also learn all about her fascinating life in her new book, Combat Love, A Jersey Girl's Search for Home. Now, over to you, Allison.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Hi, Allison.
Hey, Brian. What's up?
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's such an honor to be on with you, a national hero.
Oh, please.
I'm serious.
No, I'm not a head of state.
Yeah,
I'm not.
I'm not an
ambassador or a congressman or a president or a senator.
I beg to differ.
But it's very, very. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. And it's so nice. Nice to talk to you.
Well, likewise. Here. Likewise.
Where are you?
I'm in my home in Westport, Connecticut.
Oh, Connecticut.
Ooh. Fancy, aren't I? Ooh,
fancy. That's where... That's where the, well, I'm on the other coast, so, but that's where the New York fancy people live. I want to launch into your career and your life, but it feels like I have to say that we have an official, I guess, race for the president coming up this year, Biden and Trump. Are you so excited about this?
Beyond. I mean, do you know who's excited about this? Therapists. That's who's excited about this. The amount of money that they'll make over the next couple of years. So psychiatrists and psychologists, very excited.
Oh my God. When you said next couple of years, that's a horrible, horrible thought. I mean, we have what? We have 6 months until election day-ish? Yeah.
And it does feel as though there'll be some like act of God or like force majeure, as they say, that will keep it from happening. I mean, that's just
the election.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. God.
Feels like it. Maybe like aliens will invade. It's just, we don't have the imagination to actually, I think, imagine election day as is.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. I don't know if it'll be fun. I was listening to some sports radio yesterday who said, this is the place that you can come and not hear about all of that. But then you would be out of a job, I guess. So, I mean, we gotta watch some stuff.
Well, I mean, I guess. I feel like, you know, one of the things that really bums me out is that there's a lot of news. And I think that we've gotten so heavy on political news and certainly partisan news that there's all sorts of other human stories to be told. And I'm grateful when I get assignments to tell those other stories, because it's only in the past, I don't know anymore, 15 years that, you know, politics has become the sports of our era. But there used to be a time when polite society didn't talk politics. And right. I want to get back to that. And I'd like to get back to just human interest, other important stories to tell.
Well, I know you've been doing a lot more of that recently, and I want to talk about that. But yes, that was the rule, right?
Yeah.
No politics, religion at the dinner table. Isn't that the rule?
Yeah. Remember that?
My grandmother taught me that. You're now in lovely Connecticut. You grew up in the Jersey Shore there, Shrewsbury, New Jersey. What were you interested in as a youngster there in the Jersey Shore?
I was interested in the beach, of course, because it was the Jersey Shore. I was an only child raised by, you know, born to two intellectuals. So there were books and a lot of music around my house when I was growing up. And I would say that music is the theme that kind of bonded my parents and me together, as well as a lot of people in Monmouth County, New Jersey, which are the shore towns. Music was a big motif through our young lives. There were a lot of, I don't exactly know what the special sauce was of Monmouth County and why music was so important, if it's because we were 40 miles away from New York City and we would go in and hear live music. But there were just a lot of garage bands. My high school had a ton of bands. Bruce Springsteen is obviously from there. But I mean, Bruce is just a product. He wasn't the reason we were into music. He's just another example of how Monmouth County breeds musicians.
Right.
And so that was a big theme through my life and continues to be. Like, music was a very powerful influence.
Were your parents adventurous in their musical choices? Or was this, you say intellectuals, and so I think like they've got Beethoven rocking on the stereo.
Well, they knew a lot about Mozart and Beethoven, but I don't mean they were avant-garde intellectuals. I mean that they too understood music. And my mother, in fact, was the drama teacher at a local high school, so she put on the musicals every year. So it truly was in my DNA. She was, the first one she ever directed was West Side Story, and she was pregnant with me. So from in utero, I understood musicals and had memorized all the lyrics to musicals. So that was on in my house a lot. Different, you know, Man of La Mancha and Cabaret. And even now, I mean, those are just, they're spectacular, you know, that kind of, but anyway, my point is we weren't music snobs. We liked all different kinds of genres.
Has that carried forward for you in your time at Fox News and CNN, just the Like just a street battle. Like,
yeah.
Now every time I see you, I'm going to think that you're thinking that, by the way.
Well, I mean, isn't it true that even the CNN and Fox battle plays into the Sharks and the Jets? I mean,
yes.
Is it?
That's what I mean. That's exactly right. I'm not sure who is who at this point. I'm going to stay away from that. But yeah. You talked about in your new book, you have a new book coming out. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
You.
Combat Love, A Jersey Girl's Search for Home. We're going to talk more about that a little bit later. But you talk about being free range or kind of unparented in your book. Does that mean you were given a lot of space as a child to explore and try things?
Yes. And I think that this is a kind of universal feeling of Gen Xers. I think that a lot of us were semi-parented or unparented. We were the free range generation. And it's strange, Brian, because there was never a generation before us, I think, that was so unparented. And there certainly hasn't been one since. I mean, now the pendulum has swung to helicopter parenting, which is overkill, may I add.
Yeah.
So we were this very strange blip in like the evolution of humans where we were just turned loose for some reason as like marauding teenagers and adolescents on the streets. I don't really know where parents were in the 80s. I've tried to figure it out. I don't know if they were all at a giant cocktail party somewhere. I don't know, but they weren't around. Even like stay home mothers were never hovering. And so, it was a very free range time. And I look back on it fondly because I think that it instilled a lot of grit and, you know, self-reliance that our kids now don't have because we're helicopter parents. But as you'll read in the book, there were also many dangerous, dicey situations that could have been avoided with a little supervision, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I certainly see that. But it's funny now, you know, I have younger kids. I started late and we have to know where they are all the time now. And by the way, the phones don't help. Not that they have phones yet. I'm going to hold off as long as I possibly can.
Do that.
And the watches and all this stuff. And I was just talking to somebody recently about, like, we would get home from school or on a Saturday. Like, we just checked out. Like, we were just gone. Running through, you know, I'm from Georgia. There's woods. We were just like running through the woods. And now it would be like, even if it was quote unquote safe from other predators of one kind or another, it's like ticks or snakes or like all of those things now would be like, oh, no. You need some tick repellent on and put on this gauze mask or whatever, like to protect you from. I don't know. It's crazy. I mean, we killed a cottonhead. Yeah, that's what you call snake, like off our porch. And then the next day we were running through the woods, like not paying any attention to anything. I just can't even imagine that these days.
Me too. Our kids are totally bubble wrapped. And I don't think that it's doing them any favors to be bubble wrapped. I mean, I do think that there must be a happy medium. I know we haven't found it yet because
totally.
I don't think that kids should have been in as many cars with drunk drivers as I was. I don't think that's a good idea, but we've really overcorrected. That said, you know, my kids, I have two twins now who are in college and they're like shot out of a cannon because they're having the experience in college for the first time where they're like, oh my God, what is this? You know, that we had in high school. So I don't know, maybe postponing it 4 or 5 years is for the best. I don't know.
Yeah. It would be really hard now. I mean, I assume it still happens, but to get away with like, hey, I'm going to Johnny's house to spend the night. I'll see you tomorrow. Because there's no cell phones to text. There's not even any parent. If Johnny's parents are out of town and they just don't answer the phone, they could just be not answering the phone. Now it would be like text, call, alert.
Totally. And by the way, we did have sleepovers at people whose houses, whose parents were out of town.
Yeah.
By design.
Totally.
That was the beauty. Parents were often out of town.
Yes.
That was what we did.
Well, as you said, they were not present. So,
they were not.
As a teenager, I find this so interesting. You got into punk rock. You talked about music is going to be a theme. you started going into New York City to go to a lot of the clubs there. Do you look back fondly on those days, or do you look back and go, oh my God, I can't believe that I was doing this. And yeah, I could have gotten myself into trouble.
Well, I did routinely get myself into trouble.
but you're still here.
Yeah. That is the dividing line. I agree. I did survive, which, yes, you know, is important. I mean, spoiler alert, I did survive. But I think back on it very fondly. And I wasn't really, I want to be clear, I never was masquerading as a punk rocker. I didn't have a mohawk. I didn't have a safety pin through my cheek.
Okay.
I myself couldn't really pull off the punk rock aesthetic. But what happened was my gateway drug into punk was a local punk band from Shrewsbury, New Jersey called Shrapnel.
Okay.
And I loved Shrapnel so much. And I loved those guys in it. They were so charismatic and so cool and charming that's who I loved. And so that's why I would follow them around. And I ended up in this milieu of going to see the Ramones and the Dead Boys and the Dictators and like all of these bands. But I was really just grinning and bearing it until I could get to Shrapnel. Like that, wow. I was there for Shrapnel. And okay. So, but yes, I'm honored that I was at CBGB's in the heyday and that I was, you know, in all of those front row shows like that. I look back on it really fondly.
Oh, that's really cool. I mean, that experience of, I think, a perfect balance between like having it sounds like it wasn't so much of a bubble, but having that smaller community where you could grow up, you could explore safely certain things there, but having the city so close to be able to have that as an outlet, that must have been really fun. So this is during high school you're doing this.
Yeah. This was during high school that I was doing this. And to your point, Shrewsbury, New Jersey is basically 1 square mile, maybe 2 square miles. And it would have been Mayberry had it not been 40 miles away from the city. But somehow, because of that link that fathers got on the train there in the morning and went off to work in Manhattan and then came home. And I don't know what planted the seed with all of us kids that we thought we could do that as well, but we did. And so Shrewsbury is this very strange little pocket, or was in the 80s, where we were tethered to the city in a way that small town suburbia isn't always. And right. We did use the city and we did go see live music in the city. And I did spend my prom night at the Limelight in the city. Like we just were, we did have that combination of small town, ocean, Jersey Shore, and then that escape to have adventures in the city. And so it was, you know, if you survived it, it was magical.
Right. I promise you, you won't know that this is true. I don't relate every conversation. So I spend a lot of times not mentioning The Office, but I do have to say part of what you just talked about is something that our boss, Greg Daniels, talked about a lot, which was interesting to me, which was in terms of like why Scranton, Pennsylvania, like why choosing that? And what he was looking for was an insular community, but that was close to the big city. And so what kept those people there as opposed to being in the city or, you know, and part of it is distance and so forth, but how often did they utilize the big city or whatever and stayed where they were? So when he was coming up with where The Office was going to take place, that was his requirements. Like he wanted it to be near something large, but still insular in its own way with access to, but not in that larger community. So I don't know. I always find that fascinating.
I like that, Brian. And first of all, you can relate everything back to The Office. I'm here for it. I'm totally here for it. And I mean, we can get into how much my kids love The Office.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's so great. But I think that for me, there was something really powerful about that combination because I did like to have adventures, but mostly I was a provincial small town girl, and I liked being able to drive down the street or walk down the street and know who lived in every house. I didn't have to like them. They didn't have to be my friend,
right,
but I knew their story. And right, that was very cool to me. So there, it was to me kind of a little nest. And, you know, God knows, again, it wasn't Mayberry. There was definitely bad behavior at times happening in Shrewsbury. Right. But I liked that familiarity of that kind of provincial town.
You went on to, because you're a smarty pants, American University there in D.C. Now, were you into the punk scene there?
No, but again, because I was only into shrapnel. So no shrapnel, no punk. They're completely entwined, intertwined for me. So, but I was always into music. I mean, I went to see the Ramones. Like, you know, I was definitely in the Ramones camp. I went to see the Ramones a few times live in DC, but I always went to hear music, always. But I did cross all genres. When I got to DC, that's a kind of more southern leaning city, obviously, than New York. So there was all like NRBQ and there was Dave Matthews and all these other kind of sounds and bands that I was going to see live.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, that's a lie. I do know exactly how old you are because I have papers right here that tell me. So we're roughly the same age. So yeah,
that
Dave Matthews band, you know, coming out of Virginia, you know, that was sort of, you know, they were playing when I was in college. They were playing there at the University of Virginia. I had a friend there and that's how I got introduced to him. And that was a really, really good time there. What's always curious that I like to talk to people about who end up focusing on something and having success and excellence in it, you know, you're in an intellectual family, you're interested in music, culture, clearly as well. When for you did you start on the path of, you know, I know communications and broadcast journalism ended up being your focus. Did you go to American for that? Or at what point did you decide this was the direction you wanted to go in?
So for me, there was an actual moment that there was an actual moment where the epiphany, like the light bulb went on. So I was 15 years old. It was after school. I was sitting on the sofa and I was watching Phil Donahue. Okay. And Phil Donahue had this daily afternoon talk show that was the bomb. I mean, I loved the Phil Donahue show as a teenager. Okay. And I was watching it and truly I had one of those aha moments where I was like, what's that job called? What do you call that? Because it wasn't like TV star. It was something different. It wasn't an actor. It wasn't like, what is that he's doing? And I thought, what is that job called? And they pay him to do that. And I found out that that was called broadcast journalist. Okay. And from the moment I figured out that broadcast journalism was a profession, I was like, oh, I'm doing that. That's what I want to do. Like I saw him with his microphone, like running around the studio.
That's right.
You know, like asking people questions. Caller, is the caller there? Like it was all so fantastic. And so I only applied to colleges that had TV stations, which now they're like ubiquitous. But at the time, there were truly only a handful of them. I mean, I could tick them off. Syracuse, Ithaca, you know, American University, Northwestern. And the day I got to American, walked into the TV station, I was like, hi, I'd like to be a TV reporter. And they were like, you and 200 other freshmen, go back and get in line. Yeah. So, but that was my North Star from that moment at 15. That was it.
That is so interesting. I mean, I remember watching Phil Donahue as well, like with, I don't know why, like that's like a grandparent's memory. I don't know. Like they loved Phil Donahue.
Yes.
But in a way, I would argue that Phil Donahue, as great as he was and as entertaining as that was, and he was legit, he is a little bit of the gateway drug into where we sit today.
I don't know if any
of these people are your friends, but and then you start going into like Geraldo or Maury Povich or worse.
I agree with you. I actually agree with you. Phil Donahue, I would say, was still on the, you know, better angels side of that continuum. And I do love Geraldo, and he is a great, in real life, he is a great guy and a total mensch, and I do love him dearly. But yeah, Phil Donahue was the beginning of that continuum that leads right to like a chair being broken over somebody's head.
Right.
Or a paternity test on the Maury Povich show.
Yeah, exactly. That's very interesting. I mean, he was much more asking questions as opposed to telling you what the thing should be, which I think in a weird way that's what we need more of.
Well, totally. I mean, that's what journalism at its best is, which is you're a conduit, you know, you're a conduit and a platform for other people's stories. And so you have the microphone, and I've never not realized what a powerful platform and position that is. But you're supposed to just be a conduit. But then, you know, cable news comes along, and then it turns out in 24 hours, when you have 24-hour news, you can squeeze in some opinion and you can squeeze in some of your own analysis and everything. And so, you know, it does bleed into those other things. I agree.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Not only did Zyn create the first ever nicotine pouch, we're still America's number one choice for smoke-free, spit-free nicotine satisfaction. It could be because Zyn is made with only 6 simple ingredients, including naturally derived nicotine salt. Or maybe it's because Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day trial. For anyone worried Zyn won't cut it like traditional tobacco, just ask one of the millions of people who have achieved lasting change. You have lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. That's zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
Was it tough for you? I mean, you know, you keep talking about shrapnel, and you didn't have the mohawk, but, you know, so you're moving from at least being a fan of that into sort of what is perceived as sort of an ultra clean cut kind of identity in broadcast journalism. Was that a difficult change for you, or no? Did you just jump right into that?
Well, I think there's something about wearing the mask of an anchor person. You know, anchor people are so kind of well coiffed, and there's so much makeup that there's a veneer, you know, by design, because we're just supposed to be the messengers, you know, the conduits. And so I think that for a long time, there was something comforting for me about being able to get behind the mask, the anchor mask, and not have to reveal too much vulnerability. You know, you like cake on that makeup, and then I'm ready for the day. Like, I can ask anybody, that's my armor, you know, and then I can go to battle and ask anybody tough questions because I'm kind of behind that mask, the anchor mask. And then what started to happen for me personally was I started to feel that the mask was a little off-putting and a bit of a distance from the people that I was interviewing. And because I had a childhood, well, a teenagehood filled with some struggle and challenges, and there were times I was broke, and there were times I had nowhere to live, and there were times that I struggled with mental health, I started being tempted to say to people, I feel you. I've been there, you know, but I can't say that. That's not what news people are supposed to be doing. I mean, part of my, impulse for writing the book was peeling off that mask and showing that even your, you know, well-coiffed anchor has a story of survival and of challenges and obstacles and everything. Because I think that we often, people can project onto us all the time. You know, we are tabula rasa that people project onto. And what they project onto me often is, I've never had a hard day in my life. You know, right. I've never had a struggle. And, you know, that's just not the truth. I have.
Do you feel like that should be different? Or do you feel like that if people knew more about you, or if you projected yourself more through that mask, that makes you part of the story? I'm trying to figure out like the danger of that for you, or why you don't do that.
I think people have always been able to smell something on me. And I think it's CBGBs. No, I think that people get a whiff of something, that there is an untold story, or that I am relatable, but they can't put their finger on it. I mean, people do think that I am relatable in a way. So I hope that it's coming through the mask. But, you know, yeah, we are taught in journalism school, don't make yourself the story. Right. You know, that's just not what you're there for. You're there for other people's stories, in the service of other people's voices. So we're really taught not to do that. That's part of the discomfort. But for everybody, it's individual. Not everybody is comfortable opening the pages of their diaries and letting the world read it, of course. But for me, I just believe it's time to build bridges. I mean, because of where we are right now, because I've seen so much discord in the cable news world and in news and everybody in their silos, you know, I'm just doing my own little part to build a bridge and show that we're all, you know, more similar than we are different.
Yeah. Tell me about some of your earliest jobs. Either your first, how you got that, or what kind of stories were you covering?
Oh, you mean my earliest TV jobs? I was about to tell you about Friendlies. I was about to tell you about making Jim Dandies at Friendlies.
Okay, so
I was a waitress before I was a reporter, and restaurant work. Did you ever do restaurant work, Brian?
Yeah, but they didn't trust me with much. I was a host. I think when I signed up for it, I didn't realize how much less money you make than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause you don't get tips.
But I was a host. I was a host at a very popular, busy place.
Hooters,
so I wasn't doing nothing. Yeah, I don't think I had the patience to be a waiter. But anyway.
I see. All right. Well, maybe from your even brief stint in restaurant work, you know that it's just such a character building experience, you know? And so at Friendly's was my childhood haunt as a child in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. And then as a teenager, if we had the munchies or something.
Right.
And then I ended up working there, as my mother called it, my comeuppance. And so, you know, like scooping ice cream and everything, I think very fondly back to that and how it was character building. But if you're talking about my first reporter jobs, those are also character building. Oh my God. I mean, I made so many mistakes and they were so mortifying. I started at American University.
on the TV station that was there. So you did eventually make it through the line.
I elbowed my way in, yes. I elbowed eventually my way in after they'd given up on everybody else. Like,
right.
I had to audition along with like 200 other more talented kids. And then like those kids, you know, what happens? There's like this weeding out process and some kids realize like, ooh, I don't want to stand in a snowstorm. Or like outside of the rain or cover some crappy story. But I'm like, I do, you know? Right. So I sucked. Here's the upshot. I sucked. This was not a natural fit for me. Oh. I did, you know, I had to learn how to do a stand-up where you talk into the microphone and don't look petrified. And I was like white knuckling it. I would be somebody like, there are one take wonders. I was like a 48 take wonder, like to the point where my cameraman would be like, they all suck, but we're going to have to stick with one of them. You know, I can't take another second of this. So it was really through just repetition that I ended up getting better. And then one of my first jobs was for the crime show America's Most Wanted. And I loved every second of that. I loved crime reporting. I love The Criminal Mind, you know, trying to crack it. I loved Finding Fugitives. Right. I loved jailhouse interviews with mass murderers.
Wow.
And they would send me in to interview them. And it was a great training ground.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
It was really cool.
I like that.
Yeah.
I did something you said before, though. I had a conversation. I've become friends with Dylan Dreyer, and the whole standing outside in the middle of a hurricane thing is the dumbest thing.
Awful.
In the world.
I don't like it. I mean, I when I was 18 and 19 and 20, I would have done anything and I would have been like, put me in, coach. But now when there's a hurricane, I like hide under my desk. So they think I'm gone.
Well, it's even just like your pal Anderson Cooper does it all the time. I mean, obviously they don't want me producing these shows, but I want them to know that the consumer at home who are watching, and Anderson's like, hey, the entire area has been evacuated. No one is here. We're here on the beach in North Carolina. And you're like, get out of, what are you doing? Why are you there?
I know.
God, it's just so frustrating.
It's stressful. It is stressful. But I mean, I must tell you, viewership does go up exponentially.
Does it? Yes. Probably does. But is that like watching a reality television show that's terrible? That you're watching to make fun of it? Like, that's the thing. Is the viewership high, or it doesn't matter?
Because the viewership is higher. I don't know if it's train wreck watching or pity watching or thank God I'm not out in the elements watching or just Anderson in a wet t-shirt watching. I don't know, but I know that it's successful.
It's successful. Okay.
Yeah.
You, in 1998, you started Fox News. Boston. How did you get that job?
So interestingly, my co-anchor from American University, I worked my way up, Brian, from reporter outside in the freezing rain to anchoring at American University. And my co-anchor, who was a really talented guy, he had all of the natural skill that I did not possess. He did. He was a correspondent at Fox, and Fox had just started. Fox was going to be this new national cable news network. He was telling me about it and the great perks. And he had his own designated producer and he had his own cameraman and they would, you know, travel the country and tell these stories. And he was like, you need to send a tape there. And I said, that does sound good. You know, the show. Oh, famous last words. The show that I had been on in Boston, a national NBC morning show, had just been canceled. So I was freelancing at all sorts of different crazy shows and looking for a steady gig. And the way my friend Rick described it sounded fantastic. I sent a resume tape to the vice president in charge of programming. And I was hired, not sight unseen, because they'd seen my tape, but voice unspoken to. I mean, there was never
no interview,
no phone call. My agent called and said, like, they want to hire you. And I said, fantastic. And it was a great salary and there were great perks. And I was going to live in Boston, which is a town that that I love and always felt was home. And so it was all great. And it was just as my friend promised. It was great for a couple of years. And I was traveling around New England and doing all sorts of cool stories on Harvard medical breakthroughs or fall foliage or whatever. And then slowly it started morphing into something different. And I mean, I think what happened is that Roger Ailes sort of realized that there was this large chunk of the viewing population that felt that their voice wasn't being echoed or heard on other networks, and that there was like this beachhead that he could kind of corner. And slowly, after about 2 years, all of my stories started, I started being assigned stories with a conservative slant and some of my scripts started being changed. They wanted me to change some wording. They wanted the guests that I interviewed to be different. And it became, you know, it morphed into something like what it is today.
That's so interesting. I mean, this is such a long time ago now, obviously, and your mind doesn't remember things as they were or whatever. So Fox News, you believe, changed, which I trust you, by the way. That's not a challenge. But around 2000 or so, it became different than what it was before. Like that specific voice that is now that's famous for whatever, that actually changed while you were there. You palpably felt that the people you were talking to and the stories that you were telling had a different slant than before. Interesting.
For sure. And maybe that was always Roger's grand plan. I'm not sure. Or maybe he started to see where their bread was buttered and that it really, the times that we did stories with a more conservative angle started really resonating in the ratings. You can see as executives, you get minute by minute ratings. So you can see exactly what stories are resonating and where viewership falls off. But at some point, I know that Roger, and I know this because he told me this explicitly, Roger started playing to the crowd. You know, I mean, all of Fox started playing to the crowd. And once they figured out that it was winning and that they were resonating with this conservative, more right-wing audience, they just gunned it for that viewership. And then those were the stories that we started doing, to the point where, you know, there were times that I was let's say hosting the morning show, and every single story was from a conservative angle. There was no other, like it would be just how many different ways can you slice and dice Barack Obama in 1 hour? And I fought it to the best that I could. It's hard to fight City Hall. I would say to Roger Ailes, don't you think that gets a little redundant? Don't you think it's a little monotonous to have the same angle every hour? Like maybe I could try to be a voice for a different angle or a moderate. He was like, you know, he thundered at me. I will not have you lose the audience. You are not to do that. And so that just told me that they were all in for the audience. And as we now know, I mean, if you fast forward 10 years or 15 years from that, and you know, from the Dominion lawsuit, they ended up saying things. You hear Tucker Carlson and you hear people in the paper, I mean, in the documents of that lawsuit say, got to think about the viewers. You got to give the viewers what they want. Just we're here for the audience. You can't say that. The audience won't like it. You can't say that. That's what they do.
That's so interesting. I mean, you truly, you have enlightened me, because I think that, I don't know where it's been put in my consciousness or who taught me this or whatever, but that it was, Murdoch was conservative, so Fox is conservative. And maybe that's true as well, but they were able to keep more of a, you know, not as biased for a while, but that's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, like ratings were their religion. And so, you know, I really think that if Roger, it did dovetail with their ideology. Okay. So it all works out because Roger and Rupert Murdoch are conservative. So it ends up dovetailing. So it works for them. However, I mean, Roger also really liked the, whatever that dog show is. You know, that like that fancy dog show every year where poodles trot around.
Like the Westminster Dog Show?
The Westminster Dog Show. So like if the ratings had shown that every single segment could have been a trotting around poodle, that's what Fox would be today. But the ratings just happened to show that the viewers really liked conservative talking points.
Fascinating. Is that in part why you moved on?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. I felt like, I mean, I got in trouble all the time. It's not fun at work to be constantly like called to the woodshed and in trouble. So Roger.
For saying things on the air, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. For saying things on the air. But sometimes Roger would call me to his office and be very disgruntled about the way I was sitting. He told me he could tell I was uncomfortable with whatever conservative talking point that we happened to be doing that day because of the way I was sitting. He told me that it looked like my body had been Botoxed. And I was like, you know, Roger, I said, it's very cold in that studio. I'm freezing. He was like, nope, nope, nope. That wasn't it. It's because you were uncomfortable. And I was like, I guess he can read minds, because I was uncomfortable.
Right.
And so it's not good to be uncomfortable with what you're having to report on. And I started realizing it wasn't really news. I started not thinking that it was serving the viewers to be fed this all the time. I mean, I think it is interesting to hear conservative viewpoints for sure. And I think that smart conservative voices are really important for the democracy. But we weren't always doing smart conservative voices. We were doing just fear-mongering. You know, fear-mongering about a new mosque that was going to be built somewhere. And I didn't think that was helpful for anybody. So I was uncomfortable. Roger could see that I was uncomfortable. We fought a lot about it, or mostly I listened to him yelling. That's not sustainable.
Yeah. When you moved to CNN in 2014, did you feel like you saw opportunities there that you were not able to do at Fox News?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, when I got to CNN, it was just a garden of opportunity. To this day, I don't know how to explain it. Jeff Zucker was our president at that time, and I have asked him about this, and he can't explain. I mean, he's never taken the time to explain it to me, but a lot of us have talked to each other about this. Somehow, there was enough of the pie to go around for everyone. There were a lot of us. But I got to sit down with Hillary Clinton and do a big one-on-one. Somehow, Dana Bash got a very cool interview with whoever she was going after. Anderson Cooper got to go stand in a hurricane. You know, John Berman was going to cover, you know, a terrorist attack in Paris. Like, there was so much news happening, and all of us got to have these special moments. And when I got there, it was just like my career opened up and I got to do all of these super cool things, including, you know, host the morning show there for 7 years on its, you know, kind of a very, very successful run of it.
Yeah.
So I was really delighted because I did feel like, you know, a bit of a put on the shelf at Fox. Like Roger stopped giving me opportunities and everything because he didn't, as he said, trust me.
Interesting. You know where Jeff Zucker was before he was at CNN?
NBC.
He was in charge when The Office came on the air.
He was. So it was. Did he decide that like that would give it the green light, or was there somebody else?
You know, I should have done some research on this because I'm not sure to what degree. I mean, I've told the story. He was not a fan of the show. He didn't get it.
But yet he greenlit it or something.
Well, he had someone that was under him who really championed for it.
Huh.
But he did. He did it. He had a few people that he trusted outside that were big fans of it. And a lot of the younger people at the network, like interns and assistants, were big fans of it. But it's always interesting to me when I hear his name.
But I think that's the mark of a great executive, which is like, I don't necessarily get it, but all these guys in the demo do. Let's try it.
Let's go with that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road. But if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Ready to start your new journey? Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Enjoy Zyn nicotine pouches for 10 days and discover a fresher way to experience nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. Here's how to get started with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Simply pick your strength and varieties online and check out. Once your Zyn nicotine pouches arrive in the mail, enjoy pure nicotine satisfaction at your leisure. After your 10-day trial, let us know what you think. If Zyn isn't for you, no hard feelings. It's that simple. Order online at Zyn.com, that's Zyn.com, to start your new journey today with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's a lot happening these days,
but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
So this is sort of the lead up, kind of the now time for the 2016 presidential campaigns. Did you feel like, because of your time at Fox, you had sort of a unique perspective on coverage that you had done previously, or what kind of coverage they were going to have and what CNN was doing? Like, how did you fit in there to that very specific time?
Yeah, I definitely felt that I had a wider lens than other people because I had been at Fox, and I still feel that way. I still feel that my years at Fox were really valuable and really helped inform a worldview that I now try to carry into all of my stories, because I think that I can pretty easily channel, you know, that Roger Ailes worldview and the viewers of Fox who were always, you know, really kind to me and I got to talk to and, you know, interview a lot. And so I still feel that way. I tap into that all the time. And when I got to CNN, I think it was super helpful because, you know, we are all in our bubbles, not by design. I mean, it's not like everybody tries to be myopic or in their own bubble, but you are a product of your surroundings and your geography. And so, you know, by that time, there wasn't a lot of crossover between CNN and Fox, and there weren't a lot of people going back and forth who had worked in different places. So I was very glad that I could bring, I think, like a kind of bit of a wider aperture to my reporting at CNN.
Yeah, that's very cool. You mentioned it before, the 24-hour news cycle, which is intense. And I think, look, I think that a lot of us consumers of news get fatigued because the news is nonstop and it's not always great. And I know for myself, I'll put the phone on silent or turn the notifications off. This is something in your job you can't really do. So how do you deal with that sort of constant barrage of information and news that's coming to you, which oftentimes is not good, or at least positive, uplifting? We don't have a lot of those stories. How do you deal with that day in and day out?
Well, first of all, I commend you for turning off the notifications and the phone sometimes. And everybody has to do that, because I do think that we are in such a deluge of, you know, information, and there's so many different delivery systems that it is affecting people's mental health, for sure. I mean, obviously the research shows that. So you used to be able to just turn on the TV or turn it off at when you'd had enough. And now I just think that the drinking from a fire hose is way too much for a lot of our nervous systems. So I'm very good at compartmentalizing. I always have been good at compartmentalizing. I'm able to kind of see a story for a story and recognize that I'm here as the, again, conduit to tell that story or the platform. And I don't really take it home with me. I mean, there have been times that I've had to tell very tragic, awful stories, and they stick with me a little bit longer, but I really try not to internalize those, because then I would be useless at my job. So I'm very good at being present, you know, for however many hours the red light is on, being there, telling the story, trying to get the facts. And then after that, it is very easy for me to come home and turn on The Office or seriously, TV has always been like a real companion of mine.
Right.
And I have often used it as an escape, you know, and I can do that.
You're now reporting on the whole story with Anderson mm-hmm. Cooper. These stories are relevant and important, but a little bit of a different kind of journalism than sort of that daily news cycle. Are you enjoying that?
Yeah, I enjoyed a lot. I first started with long form, as we call it, which is not the kind of breaking news or the minute and a half news package that you see on local news. So America's Most Wanted, for instance, would tell these long yarns about these crime stories. So that was how I first was my first job was for Ted Koppel. He had a production company and he did these documentaries. So those were hour long deep dives into a particular topic. So this is a return for me to that, which is an hour long and we dive into one topic. And I really like that kind of storytelling because obviously you can't tell everything in a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And breaking news is just a different skill set. I like breaking news also, but it's a different muscle. This, what I'm doing now requires more research and writing. And I do really love the aspect of script writing and book writing or any kind of writing. So it's very nice to step off the gerbil wheel of that kind of grind, you know, particularly when you talk about gearing up for the next presidential election. I'm very happy right now to have stepped off that breathless merry-go-round, you know, and anybody who has the energy to do it, I applaud you, but I'm getting a little respite right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I watch that show. I also like on ESPN, Outside the Lines, which does the same thing. And I don't know for how many years I have been a DVRer. Do we even still say that? Mm-hmm. Of 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
It's that longer form stories that it's often not telling you exactly what's happening right now. But when people like you and your producers and all of these shows are choosing these stories, they do shine a light and illuminate in greater detail a story that does resonate with what's happening in the world today. And I like that.
Me too. I'm a DVRer also. You've just coined that phrase for all eternity.
Well, of 60 to say Minutes. I TiVo'd it, I know that's wrong. I know TiVo is done. Maybe it's just streaming now. I don't know. I can watch it on streaming.
But I do DVR it.
I do DVR it.
Yeah, so I just don't know how to turn that into a verb, but I guess we are turning that into a verb. So 60 Minutes, CBS Sunday morning, same thing. Like, I love that storytelling. It's so pleasant, you know, CBS Sunday morning. And I think that I feel smarter after those shows and I've learned something. And breaking news serves its purpose, but, you know, I often feel like my brain has been fried after breaking news, or, you know, it's just, it does something different to your cells than just sitting back and like learning about something new.
You talked about doing research and doing writing. We talked about a little earlier, your new memoir that is breaking as we speak, Combat Love, A Jersey Girl's Search for Home. How deep did you have to go into your own remembrances or recollections for these stories? Or was this the kind of book that you have been gradually writing sections in your brain as you thought of things for a long time?
Both. I mean, okay. Brian, both. These are stories that were rattling around in my brain since they happened. I tend to write episodes first. I write just a story, an episode, and then I later try to glue it together and figure out what the theme is that's presenting itself. But a friend of mine who's a great literary agent told me years ago, you know, if you're going to write a memoir, you kind of have to go there. You kind of have to leave it all on the table. And, you know, you should, if you really want to do that, you should just be prepared to do that. And so that was a longer process. I can write a story about a funny night where I snuck backstage at the Ramones concert and the hilarity that ensued back there. I can write that, but what were the feelings underneath? And what was the motivation underneath doing that? And what is the kind of, if there's a darker shadow of all of these, what seemingly might be fun stories, what is that? So that took more years to unearth and excavate, you know, what it really like. There is a part of this book that's like Gen X misadventures of music. And as we said, you know, free range time. And then there's the story of searching for home, you know, and searching for stability and feeling lonely and feeling deep depression at times. And It took me many years to weave those two stories together.
You talked earlier about wanting to give people an idea of some of your struggles because of how you at least perceive that you are viewed as a conduit and as a blank canvas, I guess, for delivering the news. Is that why you wanted to write this story, to give people an idea of really who you are and different things that you have gone through?
Well, there's a difference between writing your memoir and publishing your memoir.
So you wrote it for you.
Yeah.
And now you're publishing it for other people.
Well, I mean, I wrote it for me. And let's be honest, I'm publishing it for me. But you can write a memoir. I mean, I wrote it truly to put the pieces back together. There was a lot of unfinished business from my teenage years. I moved a lot against my will. I lived in lots of different towns and houses during a 2-year period. I didn't want to do any of that. And so sometimes all of it was happening so fast that I never adequately wrapped up one chapter, so to speak, before moving on to the next. So there were all of these stories rattling around in my head, and it was very helpful and cathartic for me to write them down, put them in a real order, go back and interview the main players in these different episodes and check my memory and make sure that it was all as intense and technicolor as I thought it was.
Right.
And so that was a healing exercise for me. Now, in terms of publishing it, once I had the whole story down in the book, then I had to make a decision of, do I really want to publish this thing? And I feel like, I don't know, I kind of waited long enough that we are in a moment of time with social media and with Gen Z that, you know, they really peel back the curtain all the time, you know, they're always sharing their feelings and everything. And so it was kind of like, I thought, why keep it a secret at this point? You know, why keep it behind the mask? Well, maybe it will help if I let people know that there were some rock bottom moments in my life too, that I crawled through to get to achieving my dream.
I think that's awesome. I mean, it's not even a humble brag. It's a brag coming. You know, I've written a book myself, so I know that there's an answer. So you can't say you don't know, because I had it. You go back and you do these interviews. What moment for you, and it may be your favorite because it's the most painful. It might be your favorite because it made you laugh. It might be your favorite because it made you look really good. What moment for you is your favorite in terms of having something illuminated based on talking to other people that sort of went against your own memory, but feel like, you know what? That's something I hadn't thought about before, but is probably really true.
That's a good question. And Brian, you could only have asked it because you went back. And I mean, I know enough about your book and I have read and I listened to one of your interviews where you talked about trying to solve the mystery, you know?
Right.
And that really resonates with me. You were trying to solve the mystery of what was the magic pixie dust that was the office? And why has it had this renaissance? What was the magic? Because like, how can we bottle it? You know, I mean, like what, how did lightning strike at that moment? And mine was also a mystery quest, you know, a trying to solve the mystery of why these teenage years were so incandescent for me and why they were so vivid and stuck with me so much. And I mean, it was really fun for me to go back and interview the main players. It gave me a chance to relive some of these moments. And as you say, to test my memory. And what I found is that my memory is fantastic.
Yeah, I know. I think mine's better than anyone else's by the way.
I have a really good memory because when I went back and I would be like, sometimes memories get diluted from telling the story too much or writing the story, it morphs. However, some of these memories were pristine because I had never spoken to the other person in this intense moment. Let's say, you know, there was a night I got stranded on a corner in Queens at like 2 a.m. on some shitty burned out corner. And the guy who stranded me, we had never spoken of it again. Okay. So it had been, you know, 35 years. And I called him and said, can I like take you to lunch and ask you a few questions? And I said, do you remember what happened on that night that we went to see Shrapnel in Queens? And he goes, and like, again, we've never spoken. He looks up and he goes, oh, something effed up happened that that night, didn't it? I was like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
It did. Like, he remembered, ooh, that was a bad, intense night, but he couldn't quite put his finger on exactly what had happened. And then I clued him in, and then we took it from there and like we're able to piece it together. And so I guess the most surprising thing that happened is that I had a best friend during that time. In the book, she's called Vivian. She was wild. She was dangerous. She was an incredibly magnetic person. And I loved her. And I loved going back and thinking about all the adventures that we had. And she said to me at some point, so she was an addict. As when we were teenagers, she was an alcoholic and then became a hard drug addict. And I was like, oh, so remember that time that we did this? And I'd be like writing it down. She said, you know, Allison, it's not as fun for me to remember these times as it is for you. And I was like, oh, right. And she said, I really wasn't well. And like, she had to just kind of take me by the shoulders and be like, this is all nostalgic and fun and games for you, but like, I lived it, you know? And that was real. That allowed a different layer of the book. Again, just the deeper layer, you know, there's the stories and then there's the, what was really happening.
Yeah. Fascinating. Everybody check it out. Combat Love, A Jersey Girl's Search for Home. Allison, you're awesome.
You're awesome.
I'm so happy to have one, met you, and two, gotten a chance for you to be so candid and open about your life and career. I can't wait to read the book.
Thank you, Ron. I can't wait for you to read the book, and I look forward to hearing what you think of it. And I really look forward to our paths crossing. Maybe I'll find you on my LA book tour and come find the little fancy town that you live in outside
of Southern California. By the way, that is now going to be my answer. Like, I have finally figured it out. Where I live in the Connecticut of Southern California. Allison, thank you so much. And good luck with the book. And listen, take care of yourself this year. You know it's going to be a struggle. Take care of yourself. And yes, our paths will cross soon for sure.
I hope so. Thanks for everything.
Allison, thank you so much. That was fascinating. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was great getting to know you. I learned so much today about you and also how the news industry works. But most of all, I learned about apparently the greatest band of all time. And I'm going to go right now listen to Shrapnel to see what all the fuss is about. Listeners, you stay tuned as we will continue to bring you breaking news. But for now, have a great week. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Ryan Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Ali Amir Sahin. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.